how much of my personality that's developed is from my depression, how much of it is me? Like, how do you separate this quote-unquote depression from how you've developed as a person?
That's Lucero Cifuentes, a 24-year-old woman living with severe depression. You're listening to Contributing Factors, Season 1, Episode 2. Contributing Factors is a Health Further production. I'm Caroline Leland, your host. Today we're exploring the clinical context of depression. We're diving into what is known about the causes and treatments of depression on a biological level, and what's being done to push the field forward. We need to point out that we'll be discussing the science and medicine surrounding depression, but nothing in this episode should or can be taken as medical advice. Every situation is unique. If you need help, please seek it out from a professional or find a trusted friend to help you do that. Your doctor and care team can give you qualified advice and treatment that can make a real difference. Okay, so now we can dive into the fourth chapter of this series, Cifuentes' story. One of the biggest challenges in treating mental illnesses like depression is that so much of it is still trial and error. We know certain medicines work for certain people, but we don't necessarily know which meds will work for which people or what the dosage should be. Because unlike other diseases, the dosage you might need for an antidepressant is not necessarily correlated with how severe your depression is. It's much more difficult to define and measure psychiatric disorders than it is for diseases like diabetes and cancer, even as challenging as those diseases can be. Cifuentes has had depression for as long as she can remember, but only after years of suffering did she find a course of medication that works for her.
And I'm pretty content with my medication. It's like the sixth one I've been on.
A couple of years ago, just before she moved from North Carolina to Spain, Cifuentes had genetic testing done. The results led her doctor to prescribe something different.
She basically told me my Prozac was doing nothing. She was like, you need a different medication. And I have noticed more mood stability with fluvoxamine, which is what I'm on now.
But Cifuentes is nervous about how much her body, not just her mood, relies on that medication. She's an active 24-year-old who likes traveling and, like all of us, wants to feel independent.
I forgot to take it for a few days on a trip, and I started withdrawing. And I didn't realize what was happening, but I was sweating profusely, I was nauseous, I was vomiting, I was weak, I was sleeping all the time. I had no idea what was happening. And my roommate, I remember, looked up my symptoms, and she said, I think you're withdrawing from your medication. And sure enough, like, I immediately, when I started taking it, all my symptoms went away. But that kind of scared me, because I was like, I'm having the same symptoms as a drug addict. I'm a little uneasy about how strong my medication is and my dosage, and I'm trying to decide what to do about it.
It's clear from even these few aspects of Cifuentes' experience that medicating a psychiatric illness is a complex process. Scientists haven't really determined causes of depression per se, just factors that are correlated to the disease. Predispositions and precipitating events. Genetic counselor Janine Austin works to help people understand some of this complexity and how it affects their lives.
My name is Janine Austin. I am an associate professor in the departments of psychiatry and medical genetics at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, Canada. And I hold the Canada Research Chair in Translational Psychiatric Genomics here. And I'm also Executive Director of the BC Mental Health and Addictions Research Institute. So my work is all about trying to make what we know about the genetics of psychiatric disorders useful and meaningful to people who live with these conditions and their families.
During our interview with Austin, we shared a little bit of Cifuentes' story. We told Austin how the results of Cifuentes' genetic test not only helped her find a course of medication that worked, but it also made her feel that her disorder had been validated. Finding a genetic basis for her depression proved to her that her lifelong emotional struggles were biological and not a symptom of personal failure. But those overwhelming feelings of relief meant that she didn't catch much of the genetic counselor's explanations.
I think in that moment, the only thing I was taking in, I just remember, you know, when someone's talking and you kind of ignore it, I was just kind of in my own thoughts being like, it's not great news, but for me it was great news to have someone finally explain that it wasn't my fault.
A Upon hearing that, Austin told us she would love to talk directly to Cifuentes to help her understand more about the results of that test, to help her hear what she hadn't heard when the results first came back. So we set up a call between the two. Cifuentes, a patient with lifelong depression, and Austin, a genetic counselor with a passion for helping patients understand their diagnoses.
So, hello, Lucy. Is it all right if I call you Lucy?
Yes, Lucy's fine.
Okay, great. It's really nice to virtually meet you today. I'm really excited that we get to have a conversation together. To do genetic counselling together about your family history of psychiatric illness. So just as a way of getting started today, I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit in your own words about what it is you'd be interested in talking about, what sorts of questions you have that you were hoping I might be able to answer, that sort of thing.
Well, I was told I had depression. I mean, just kind of like nonchalantly, I feel like when I was like maybe just so young, like 10 maybe, like very young, the doctor was like, she's displaying symptoms of depression. I didn't really know what that was.
Cifuentes and Austin went on to chat for over an hour and a half. For this episode, we'll include just a little bit to show how someone like Austin can help someone like Cifuentes process and understand the genetic roots and personal implications of her own mental health.
Right. So the way to think about it is that, bearing in mind that every single one of us has genetic vulnerability to mental illness, right? Every single one of us. So in a sense, we're all vulnerable to these things. So yes, for all of us, mental health care is important. You have already experienced active episodes of illness, right? You've experienced panic attacks, you've experienced depressive crises. And so it's just that for you, it's thrown into more sharp relief the need to take care of these things than it is for others. But it's important for all of us, right? So yes, the need to take care of our mental health is a lifelong concern for every single one of us. But this does not mean that you're broken or defective or wrong in any way at all. It's just that for you, you've experienced acute crises, and so you know personally how unpleasant that is, and you would like to avoid it. And so these are just some tools that you can use that we have really good evidence for from research. Yeah.
Okay.
So basically what I'm saying is, what I want you to take away is that it's not one or the other. You know, you started out at the beginning, we talked a little bit, is it nature or nurture? It's not one or the other. It's not, and when I say nurture, I actually don't like the word nurture because it suggests our home environment. It suggests parenting style. Whereas, I've been talking about environmental factors, right? Which is a lot broader than just what we experience in our parental interactions. So it's there. Yes, we all have some genetic vulnerability to this stuff, but it also depends whether or not we experience a mental health problem depends on the experiences that we have in our lifetime. And some of those things we may not be able to control, but we do know of some things that we can do to protect mental health. They're not always easy. You know, this whole sleep, nutrition, exercise, social support network stuff is not easy. And so when we're trying to make improvements in those areas, it's really important that we don't go beating up on ourselves with a guilt stick about like, well, I had fries for lunch and pizza for dinner yesterday, and so it's all my fault if I have another episode, right? It's we have to practice self-compassion together with all of these other strategies.
Cifuentes says the conversation was insightful for her, but she's still frustrated that she didn't get an explanation like that when she was first prescribed antidepressants.
Seeing it laid out like that, like this is how my brain works, it was easier to relate. But at the same time, like I think there's some questions or some things that can never be answered. And that kind of bothered me thinking about it afterwards. How much of my personality that's developed is from my depression? How much of it is me? Like, how do you separate this quote-unquote depression from how you've developed as a person? But that's just a question that can't really be answered, I feel like.
Chapter 5, Nature and Nurture. As implied by Cifuentes' struggle for clarity about her health issues, diagnosing and treating mental health problems can be tricky. Even though what we call mental illness has a clear biological basis, the scientific community still doesn't fully understand all that much about the functioning of the incredible organ we call the brain. Nashville-based psychiatric nurse practitioner Mary Carter explains this challenge.
The one frustrating thing in mental health, as opposed to other fields of medicine, is that we can't draw levels of serotonin and check your blood work and see how low a person's serotonin is, or norepinephrine or dopamine, whatever it might be. We're so often saying to a person, your symptoms outwardly really indicate that your brain chemistry is not well regulated right now. That's our best hypothesis, and there's no way to confirm that necessarily without some really extensive testing that would be unnecessary. So we are treating our hypothesis, so to speak, that the serotonin levels in your brain are not well regulated.
Despite how much we don't know, we know a few things for sure. As you've heard, we know that depression is correlated with improper functioning of the neurotransmitter serotonin. That's a chemical in your brain that helps maintain mood balance. We also know that depression is linked to environment as well as biology.
I mean, we always say that genetics loads the gun, so to speak, and environment pulls the trigger for whatever mental health disorder a person might be dealing with. It's kind of a violent analogy, but it's a good one to kind of give that picture that you may have a predisposition for something and it may never emerge, or you may have a predisposition for something and life circumstances kind of trigger that to emerge.
Austin, Texas-based clinical social worker Rachel Massell says your childhood is an important time when it comes to environmental triggers of depression.
There's a lot more research coming out over the last 20 years about what are called ACEs, which is short for adverse childhood events. And these are things like growing up in poverty, being exposed to domestic violence, being the victim of abuse, things that compromise a child's feeling of safety. And so any of those things are given a point, so to speak, on the scale. And the more ACEs you have, the higher your ACE score is, the more likely you are to encounter a number of negative outcomes in your adult life that span all types of health problems, as well as social, economic problems, even though these things happened many years ago. And so a component of that is these traumas, these stressors may also cause our genes to, quote unquote, turn on and leave us with a case of clinical depression, whereas if we had more of a secure childhood or a lower ACEs score, then we might not experience a case of clinical depression.
Another thing we know is that depression is most often effectively treated by both medication and psychotherapy. Medication can help address the biological components of depression, while psychotherapy, also known as talk therapy, can help a person process some of the environmental factors that may be contributing to the disease. Here's Michelle again.
So I tell my clients that there are two main options, especially if this is the first time that they are seeking out treatment. You've got therapy on the one hand and medication on the other. And both are pretty effective, especially the earlier you intervene, the more likely either one is to be effective on its own. However, it does appear that the combination of the two, therapy and medication, is going to get the largest effect. Both things will enhance what's called neuroplasticity, which is the ability of the brain to create new neural pathways, which is what we need to do when we're depressed. We need to get out of these neural grooves that predispose us to think negatively and reinforce this depressed mood and be able to change our brain on a functional and structural level. And so we know that SSRIs have that effect, and we know that psychotherapy has that effect. So if you're doing both, you have this likely heightened ability to change your brain.
Because of the unwanted side effects that come with medication, Carter usually recommends that her patients try therapy before meds.
Only because therapy changes the brain and changes the way the brain processes information, the way the brain communicates with itself. You actually see brain changes through the course of talk therapy, similar to what you would see in medication. So if someone's hesitant to start with medication, let's do therapy for a little while. Let's try some of these alternative therapies. If we're not seeing improvement at that point, why wouldn't we use this tool that we have access to that could really improve your quality of life?
Medication, though often the more affordable option to the patient, is less than an ideal solution because of unpredictable side effects.
If it's not improving your quality of life, then there's no reason to be taking it. I often tell people that as well. Sometimes either side effects or just the idea of taking medication every day is negatively impacting quality of life so much so that maybe this is not the best option for you. You know, the only reason to take medication would be for it to improve your functioning, your quality of life, your enjoyment in life.
If things weren't difficult enough already, side effects almost always show up before the patient experiences any of the intended benefits of the medication.
That's one of the biggest challenges, is when you're depressed and you're finally ready to seek help, you'd like something that works sooner rather than later, and patiently waiting for the medication to kick in and seeing which side effects are going to show up and are they tolerable? Will they go away before you even feel better?
How does this play out in real life? Let's look at Cifuentes' story again. She has dealt with her fair share of unpleasant side effects and ineffective therapy. We'll start with the side effects. Whenever Cifuentes started a new medication, she worried about weight gain. She also suffers from excessive drowsiness and insomnia. One of the biggest side effects is one of the hardest to talk about.
Like, I never noticed, but it decreases your like sexual desire and stuff. And I just don't have, like, for a while, like, all my friends are like, are you asexual? Because like, I just don't, because it's like, I feel like I have so many other things to worry about. Like, I just have no interest in anything. And I realize it's probably just like the medication, because I was reading about it and like my specific medication, like I was reading online and people were like, yeah, I can't have an orgasm because I'm on this medication, or I haven't had sex in like so long with my husband since I'm on this medication. I was just kind of like, aha.
Cifuentes hasn't dated much, so it hasn't negatively affected her life.
Like right now it's not an issue. In fact, like probably my parents would say it's a blessing.
But whenever she does find the right person to start a relationship with, she'll have to figure out how to navigate that challenge on top of everything else. So side effects are a thing, but they don't keep Cifuentes from taking her meds. However, she has experienced more limiting barriers to sticking with therapy. When Cifuentes started attending therapy during undergrad, she got free sessions administered by a psychology graduate student.
And I remember I finally started opening up about it, and the girl that I would go see, I remember looking up and she was tearing up. Like I could see tears falling down her cheeks as I was explaining how I felt. And I think I started to pity myself at that point. Started to like maybe feel more sorry for myself, because I was like, she's a trained therapist. Like she's going to be a therapist one day and she's crying at what I'm telling her. Like I must really be messed up. There must be something really wrong with me.
Part of the problem was that Cifuentes not only had depression, but also a lesser known disease called body dysmorphic disorder, or BDD for short. BDD works by distorting the way you see a certain part of your body. In Cifuentes' case, it was her skin, specifically the skin on her face. Basically, whenever she looked in the mirror, she saw a monster. This compelled her to obsessively apply layers upon layers of makeup and other skin products every morning. She didn't go out to party at night because of the cultural focus on appearances. Her favorite days were rainy days because she could hide her face with her umbrella. And from what Cifuentes could tell, the graduate student therapist she saw in college didn't really know how to handle it.
I kept going to her, but I don't know how much it helped, because I felt she didn't understand and she was still learning about this illness herself. And I found that with a lot of doctors that I went to, ones that my mom would take me, that they would have to look up in the DSM-5.
That's the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual for Psychology.
They didn't understand it, so I didn't feel understood. I just felt like I was being vain, which made me feel more guilty. And it was just a vicious cycle.
Cifuentes has also dealt with some unprofessionalism in clinical settings. She says the clinician who administered her genetic test implied that Cifuentes had enough to be happy about that she shouldn't be depressed.
She was like, "Why are you depressed? You're so pretty." And I remember just being disgusted in the moment that she said that, because that had been such a trigger for me in the past.
Because part of depression is feeling guilty for being depressed.
And for a nurse practitioner who I was there to get medication from to tell me that was really disheartening, in that I was like, she doesn't get it. Like, she's someone who's supposed to be helping me, and she doesn't truly understand, because she's this idea that the beauty comes with happiness. She's just kind of endorsing that idea. And I kind of like tried to let it go, but the next time I came, she was like typing things up and doing paperwork, and she said, "Oh, so do you have a boyfriend?" And I said, "No." She said, "Why?" Like, she was trying to make small talk, but she didn't realize that she was just not helping in any way. And I got that a lot, just not just from her, but I went to another nurse practitioner. I mean, I've been to a lot of doctors. She would say the same thing. Like, I would walk in and she was just like, "Oh, you look so beautiful today. I bet the boys are all over you," or, "Oh, you have everything going for you." And I was just like, it's not your job to comment on my personal life or on why I might be depressed. It's your job to help me through what I am feeling. There's a special way, I think, certain way that you should and shouldn't talk to someone who is going through depression.
Whether or not that implication was intentional on the practitioner's part, or even if it was misperceived by Cifuentes, regardless of how the actual dialogue in the office went, this is how it made Cifuentes feel. It's the truth of her experience and therefore worthy of consideration.
I've had therapists or nurse practitioners or doctors that have just not gotten it right in the way they approach me and the way they approach medication and the small little comments that they make about depression, that it just makes you obvious like they don't get it. And in fact, I think I have a huge mistrust in doctors and in the health system because of my history with depression. Because it's just like, why did it take so long to get it right? Like, why did I have to go through all of this before someone was finally like, "Oh, this is the one that's right for you, and this is what you need to do."
Chapter 6, We Really Don't Understand the Brain. Of course, we all wish doctors could know what to prescribe the first time. We wish doctors even had medications that we knew would work. We wish all doctors were perfect in their knowledge and had all the tools they needed to make patients' lives better right away. But the limitations of our scientific understanding makes those kinds of accurate predictions virtually impossible. Here's Dr. Austin, the genetic counselor, again.
So I've already told you that depression is not just a gene on its own, it's gene plus environment, but it's even messier than that.
Austin says there are probably hundreds of genetic variations that can increase a person's vulnerability to developing depression or other psychiatric problems. So two people with the same diagnosis might actually have arrived at that exact set of symptoms from entirely different pathways. There are always different underlying genetic variations contributing vulnerability, and also different life experiences contributing vulnerability. It's a very complex picture. Genes and environment working together in innumerable possible combinations of those components. To complicate things further, the genetic variations that influence whether or not we respond to a certain medication are not necessarily going to be the same variations that make us more vulnerable to developing depression in the first place. You might expect that those variations would overlap, but they don't necessarily. Even the physiological basis of the disease is more complex than you probably realize. Remember how we told you at the beginning of this episode that Cifuentes' depression was caused by her brain's inability to produce enough serotonin? That was way oversimplified. We don't actually know what the root of the problem is. We definitely know that serotonin becomes imbalanced in the context of depression.
But like, is that the fundamental root of all of the problems, or is it imbalanced just simply as a result of something else having been thrown out of whack in the first place, right? So we have a tendency to want to make it really simple when it's really not at all simple.
And everything we understand thus far is wholly limited by the tools we've developed to studying the disease. The ways we approach looking for the genetic contributions to the disease are always driven by and limited by the technology that we have available.
Which necessarily means there's a whole bunch of other stuff probably going on that we don't have the technology to look at yet.
Austin isn't even all that confident in the use of genetic testing to diagnose mental illness or to determine a course of medication, which is an approach called pharmacogenetics. There are not actually at present any clinical practice guidelines that recommend the use of pharmacogenetic testing for any psychiatric disorders. We just don't have enough data yet to allow us to be confident in how to interpret the results.
People will always interpret the results for you. And in fact, there are a number of companies that provide pharmacogenetic testing for antidepressant response that you can find on the internet, and you can pay them money and they will give you results back saying you should try that, you know, don't use this one, do use that one, and so on.
But those recommendations aren't necessarily agreed upon by the scientific community.
We just don't have sufficient evidence to recommend pharmacogenetic testing yet as a strategy for determining what medication one should be taking.
However, the accuracy of those predictions are going to get better as more research is focused on this area.
There's so much hope and enthusiasm about this type of testing.
As we saw with Cifuentes, for people who live with these disorders, the process of finding a medication that works can be painful.
Trial and error and side effects. And, you know, we often say side effects as if it's just something light and trivial. They're often really not. They're often debilitating side effects.
How wonderful it would be if we had a genetic test that we could have complete confidence in. One that we understood fully how to interpret the findings and use them to help a patient find a medication that would work for them the first time.
If we could circumvent the whole trial and error process, that would be absolutely spectacular.
At this time, clinicians like Carter use genetic testing to predict a patient's metabolism rates for certain drugs.
What we can do is use a cheek swab to get a little bit of the patient's DNA and send it to a lab to be evaluated, and it'll actually tell us how patients metabolize each of the mental health medications. It'll do it for depression medications, ADHD medications, anxiety, bipolar. You get a huge printout of here's how they metabolize medications. And so that just helps give you a cleaner starting place to look at. If you know a patient is a really slow metabolizer of X medication, it may not be your first choice, where without that information, you may have gone to that medication because you know it works great or whatever. You may have recommended it. So it's a kind of a great tool that helps us just get a cleaner picture of, hey, let me at least just target what I know this person metabolizes normally. Now that's still the frustrating piece of that is it still does not indicate effectiveness.
With all that in mind, it's amazing that scientists have been able to develop medications that work at all. We interviewed a neuroscientist to gain a little more background on how those do in fact often work. So now we're going to detour out of the "we don't understand our brains" chapter and jump briefly back into the "nature and nurture" chapter with a little more specificity about physiology. Chapter 5.1, The Tiny Vacuum Cleaners in Your Head.
I'm Randy Blakely. I am the executive director of the Florida Atlantic University Brain Institute. My research as a neuroscientist is into molecules that control how brain synapses work and what happens when these molecules do not work properly, how they impact risk for brain disorders.
Blakely's lab does some pretty cool research.
Work in my lab runs the gamut from studying molecules in a test tube and sort of your garden variety biochemistry experiment to studying genes that we introduce and modify in cells and culture to evaluation of changes in genes in living animals, mostly mice, studying their behavior when genetic mutations or environmental challenges are introduced.
His research basically sets out to understand the information intranet that the brain uses to communicate within itself. As you may remember from high school biology, this communication system uses chemicals as well as electric impulses to transfer messages.
Chemical signaling in the brain is a way in which two neurons, two nerve cells, talk to one another. Excitation of one neuron, a little burst of electrical activity, travels from the cell body region of a neuron down to the tip of its processes, something we call an axon. And then there is a gap between the end of that process and the cell body of the next neuron. And in order to transmit the signal from one neuron to another, a chemical is released in response to that first electrical signal, and it travels to the second neuron, and that's chemical transmission.
Of course, there are specific scientific terms for each element of those processes.
So this cell to cell to cell passage of electrical signaling is done by these chemicals at the space between one neuron and another that we call a synapse. And so this is a process called synaptic communication. And the chemicals that move between one neuron and another are called neurotransmitters.
It's important to understand these processes if you hope to understand the etiology of depression and therefore how to best treat and prevent it.
We're learning that the changes that occur in the brain of someone with mental illness occur at multiple levels. It appears that there are changes in the ability of a nerve cell to signal to another nerve cell with particular neurotransmitters like the chemical serotonin. There are changes in the strength of synapses, how much of a chemical signal one nerve cell sends to another for a certain amount of electrical activity. You can imagine that if you need, let's say, 1,000 molecules of serotonin to be released and to activate or modulate the next cell, if you're only releasing, let's say, 100 molecules, there is a deficiency there that may need to be remedied or could be remedied.
However,
it's much more complicated than that. As neurons and their synapses talk to one another, the circuitry within the brain, the microcircuitry within the brain, changes. We see the growth of some processes that neurons have, their shape changes, their partners change, who they talk to changes, and ultimately strengths of signaling across wide areas of the brain can be affected.
So what's the takeaway here?
We're increasingly understanding that changes occur in depression throughout the brain, and this makes it a very complicated disorder, both to pinpoint exact places within the brain where the key changes are occurring, and also to remind us that depression is both a mood disorder and a thought disorder.
Well, how can our treatments work at all when the disease is so complex and we understand so little of its pathways?
If you're releasing a neurotransmitter that is normally a faithful communicator between one cell and another, and that signal becomes diminished, the signaling becomes erratic, and the strength of impulses that would normally allow you to process information in your daily world in a healthy way are diminished. And this is where pharmacotherapy tries to restore aspects of chemical signaling, and where cognitive behavioral therapy or psychotherapies try to help you change your own synapses by changing your own thought patterns.
This brings us to the actual drugs used for the pharmacotherapy Blakely is talking about.
So the drugs like Lexapro and Prozac,
those are a couple of the most common pharmaceutical antidepressants,
act to enhance the activity of serotonin. And the way they do that is they inhibit proteins called serotonin transporters that would normally clear serotonin away from nerve cells and recycle them for later use. So nerve cells are constantly releasing these chemicals onto their partners to stimulate them and to talk to them. But those signals have to be brief. Otherwise, you wouldn't be able to sense the next signal. So you always want a very low baseline, and then you can stimulate on top of that. And so the serotonin transporter, and there's a dopamine transporter for dopamine, these transporter proteins clear out the neurotransmitter after it's released and after it's had a chance to signal. They get rid of them. They act like little nano vacuum cleaners.
Dopamine, which you just heard him mention, is a neurotransmitter similar to serotonin.
So a serotonin selective reuptake inhibitor is blocking, or it's inhibiting, serotonin reuptake, or the uptake of the neurotransmitter through one of these transporters. They're like little plugs or corks that go into the end of the tube of a vacuum cleaner and don't allow it to remove the neurotransmitter from the environment anymore. And the consequence of that, of course, if it were a vacuum cleaner in your house, is that dirt would build up. In the case of your brain, let's not think of it as dirt. Let's think of it as important chemicals that are needed to signal from one cell to another. So now, without the removal of these chemicals, we are allowing them to build up. We're allowing them to signal stronger than they used to. And for individuals where this kind of boost modifies circuits that are altered in depression, this can be an effective therapy.
Blakely also has a theory for why antidepressants take so long to take effect.
Depression is a very complicated disorder, as we've talked about, and it involves changes in your brain, not wholesale macroscopic changes, very tiny changes in the way nerve cells talk to each other, we think. But those changes have come about over many weeks or months or even years. And so reversing those changes and setting things right can also take some time.
Of course, researchers like Blakely want depressed patients to experience relief more quickly. That's a large focus of current research in the field. And this brings us to Chapter 7, What's Next in Biological Research? The Immune System, Ketamine, and Pharmacogenetics. There's tons of research and scientific discoveries happening always. Blakely, the researcher whom you just heard from, is particularly enthused about new understandings the scientific community is gaining regarding the connection between the brain and, of all things, the immune system.
One of the areas that I find most exciting is a realization that the immune system is in a constant state of communication with the brain, and that this communication can be altered and can be influenced in ways that can trigger depressive-like states, and that perhaps working through immune signaling pathways, we could develop novel antidepressants. Now we're beginning to think that at least some individuals come to their depression because of changes in immune function.
Another more recent discovery, a medication that's now in clinical trials, is the use of a drug called ketamine for short-term antidepressant relief. Ketamine is a tranquilizer often used for anesthesia. It's been abused as a recreational drug, which complicates its availability. But it's being celebrated for how quickly it offers relief to severely depressed patients, especially suicidal ones. The effects are short-term but can be life-saving. Here's psychiatric nurse practitioner Mary Carter again.
To see this ketamine, how rapidly and almost universally it eliminates the suicidality and these depressive symptoms, even though it's temporary, it's very hopeful. And so it's a place to look at how do we replicate this in a more long-term way, while also balancing that it's a highly abusable medication and how do we regulate that and keep people safe around it as well.
Janine Austin is especially hopeful about the potential progress to be made in pharmacogenetics, that process of using genetic information to prescribe medication.
It would be absolutely spectacular to have a test that we could use and be confident about that helps us to choose a medication that's going to work well for somebody with the least chance of side effects. That's something that really matters to me. We really do have some phenomenal minds working on this problem, and I'm really hopeful that it's actually going to pay off for people who live with these conditions and their families.
With so much uncertainty around medication and psychotherapy, that is, the most conventional treatments for depression, It's worth mentioning that alternative therapies have maintained popularity. These include brain stimulation therapies like electroconvulsive therapy, light therapy, which uses a light box to expose a person to full-spectrum light in order to regulate the hormone melatonin. Exercise is often prescribed to help combat depression. Less scientific treatments include acupuncture, meditation, nutrition plans, self-management strategies and education, and spiritual approaches like faith and prayer. Even Cifuentes, who fully depends on her antidepressant meds, has faced criticism for taking them.
And then there is a lot of people who have tried to tell me to get off my medication. Like, maybe you should try something else, like a more holistic approach, or you should try this, or you should try that, or I refuse to take medication because I don't want to put something so strong in my body without realizing that some people need it. I will be on antidepressants until the day I die. I just have to. Like, there's no other choice for me. So for people to constantly be trying to look for other options or tell me that maybe I should come off of it is somewhat frustrating, because they don't truly understand that it's something that I need for my body.
For Cifuentes, running was enough to keep her mood disorder at bay in middle school. Soon that wasn't enough. She suffered through the typical trial and error prescription of various antidepressant meds before a genetic test helped her find one that worked. Now her mood is stabilized, though she'll fight depressive symptoms for her whole life. So it's not quite a happy ending, but with where the field stands today, it's as close as we'll get. Now, a sneak preview of our next episode.
So I started thinking about healthcare decision-making is very peopled, that it wasn't in your head, that it was about the people who surrounded you. I tried to develop a model that struck me as much more messy and complex, but much more realistic in how people got to care.
More on that in our next episode, where we discuss the social context of depression. Contributing Factors is hosted by me, Caroline Leland. I also wrote and produced this series. David Schifrin is our executive producer, Stephanie Edwards is our music supervisor, Matt Faulkner leads marketing, and additional creative assistance is provided by Michaela Powell. Our original theme music is written and performed by Matt Phillips. The track can be heard on his upcoming album, so be sure to check him out at ilikemattphillips.com. That's Matt with two T's and Phillips with two L's. A big shout out to Chris Connor for extra technical assistance with the audio in this episode. Special thanks to Lucero Cifuentes for allowing us to share her story, and to Janine Austin for generously giving her time to join Lucero for the genetic counseling session. Dr. Austin, we are so grateful for your support. Many thanks also to Randy Blakely, Mary Carter, and Rachel Massell. Contributing Factors is a Health Further production. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, and Google Play. For bonus content from this episode, including the full interviews with everyone you heard from today, and importantly, that genetic counseling session between Dr. Austin and Lucero, go to healthfurther.com/contributing-factors. While you're there, you can learn more about Health Further and everything we have going on. You can also find us on Twitter at Health Further. Please take a minute to rate and review Contributing Factors on Apple Podcasts, and then share it with your community. Your participation and support is what makes this show succeed, so thank you for being here and for helping spread the word. Join us next week as we look at the social and cultural contexts of depression.